Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, with a winning lineup of sports titles, which I think is a perfect matchup during this March Madness season. We'll cover basketball, football, baseball, and take a look at some of the winning personalities who've shaped our obsession with sports from early days. Combine passion with some fascinating backstories, and we've got a great game plan for today's show. Let's start the clock and turn to page one of The Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Legendary writer Jimmy Breslin tells the tale of Branch Rickey. In 1947, as president and general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Rickey defied racism on and off the field to bring Jackie Robinson into the major leagues, changing the sport and the nation forever. Rickey's is the classic American tale of a poor boy from Ohio whose deep-seated faith and dogged work ethic took him to the pinnacle of success, earning him a place in the Hall of Fame and a place in history. Best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jimmy Breslin provides a lively portrait of Rickey and his times, including such colorful characters as Dodgers owner George V. McLaughlin, dubbed George V for his love of scotch, Diamond greats Leo Durocher, Dizzy Dean, and Robinson himself, a man whose remarkable talent was equaled only by his resilience in the face of intolerance. Breslin brings to life the heady days when baseball emerged as the national pastime in this inspiring biography of a great American who remade a sport and dreamed of remaking a country. Dick Hill narrates.
Beautiful. When they asked me to write a book about a great American, right away I say yes. When I say yes, I always mean no. They asked me to choose a subject, and I say, Branch Rickey. He placed the first black baseball player into the major leagues. His name was Jackie Robinson. He helped clear the sidewalks for Barack Obama to come into the White House. As it only happened once in the whole history of the country, I would say that is pretty good. Then some editors told me they never heard of Rickey, which I took as an insult, a disdain for what I know, as if it is not important enough for them to bother with. So now I had to write the book. Simultaneously, I had a problem for a writer as bad as sprained hands. The rule I followed from my first day as a cappy boy in the sports department was that you couldn't write about a game unless you went to see it. These people who tried reporting by watching television were killing readers with lifeless stories. It still is like this, except there are many fewer readers to murder. The trouble is, I spoke to Branch Rickey only once in my whole life. I am with my friend Rusty Wild at Ebbets Field, where maybe 200 spectators sit in a big rainstorm watching the Brooklyn Dodgers football team play against the Chicago Rockets. I was a copy boy after school at the old Long Island Press and got the tickets from the sports department. The newspaper is gone, as are both teams. Into the seat behind me comes Rickey, the Dodgers owner, in a yellow slicker with lackeys to the left and right. He says, "Hello, boys." I am on my high school football team and must show how much I know. I ask him why his star quarterback is playing what was known as a single-wing formation. They start each play by passing a wet ball back to him, and in all this mud, you can't handle the ball so good. He ought to be in a tee, I say. We got the best tee quarterback ever to live from around here. Ricky says, who is that? I say, Sidney Luckman. Ricky says, I've heard of him. He was playing me for a fool. Luckman was already a legend. I say, he comes out of Erasmus Hall High at Flatbush and Church. My uncle took me to see him play Lincoln down by Coney Island. I was as smart as they come. Ricky now ignores me, and I don't pick up half of what I could have. I wanted to go back to the sports department at the school newspaper and show off with what I heard him say. When I did overhear him, I concentrated totally on every word. I hunched over and wrote a couple of key words on a sheet of copy paper that was folded in three. That was the way the big reporters did it. The paper was cheap city room newsprint. I wrote concept of education and leading characteristic match their ability. If I had paid attention like this in school, I would have had a full scholarship to Oxford. I never saw Branch Rickey again, and now I am going to write a great book about him. I was sure I had a lifesaver. Jack Lang, whom I know for maybe 50 years, has been writing newspaper stories about Rickey for a long time. I am going to see him next week. Then I am in the shower, and my wife hollers, Jack Lang died! I said a prayer. After a period of mourning, I started again. I called Emil Buzzy Bavazzi at his home in San Diego. He was an assistant to Ricky and was in the room when they decided to bring up Jackie Robinson. Come out and we'll go over the whole thing, he said. 2 days later, I pick up the paper and read that Buzzy died. I figured I would be able to rely on big-name historians whom I have yet to read and that this would be immensely pleasurable. And then I read the books. History writers should be put not in the jail, but under it.
That was Branch Rickey by Jimmy Breslin. My guest today, Michelle Kaufman, has been a sports writer for 21 years. Her sports journalism career began at the St. Petersburg Times, where she covered the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. She was one of the only women covering the NFL at that time. From there, she went to the Detroit Free Press, where she spent 7 years before returning home to the Miami Herald in 1996. Michelle has covered 10 Olympics and 4 World Cups. Welcome, Michelle. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Sure, I'm happy to be here.
All right. Which sports columnist did you read while you were growing up that kind of led you into your field?
I didn't really know I was going into this field when I was a kid, so I wasn't reading it for that reason, but I did always like Edwin Pope of the Miami Herald. I grew up in Miami, and Edwin Pope and Bob Rubin were the two columnists that were down here. So then one writer that did have an influence on me was Christine Brennan. She was working at the Miami Herald at the time. She was a young reporter, and when I got to UM and I was taking a journalism class there, she came and spoke at our class. And immediately after meeting her, I thought, I could be her. I could be like her. So I went up and I asked her for her business card, and I started thinking about sports writing after listening to her. So, and she ended up really being a mentor throughout my career. We're very good friends now. She's not even that much older than me, but when I was in college, she was in her early 20s. She was just getting started, and so I related to her. And she went on to the Washington Post. She was the first woman to cover the Washington Redskins, and now she's a columnist at the USA Today. So she's someone who definitely influenced me.
Did she feel that it was, you know, was she doing breakthrough stuff as a woman, kind of one of the first to get into the locker room?
Yes, she was. And then I was shortly thereafter. I started working at the St. Petersburg Times. And 1 year out of college in 1988, they gave me the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beat. So I was the NFL beat writer and I was 23 years old. And at that time, I was the only woman beat writer in the whole United States that was a full-time NFL beat writer that particular season. And definitely at my newspaper, I was the first one to do that. And it was quite an experience. I was young and inexperienced, and all of a sudden I'm thrown into the situation. And yeah, there were many, many horrible locker room incidents and people yelling things at me and people saying gross things. And there were many, many times where I wondered if I really wanted to do this, if it was worth it. But I'm glad I stuck with it. Times are a little better now, but it's still, there are still only about 600 female sports journalists in the United States, and there are 1,500 newspapers, and that's it. So there will be a press corps of 7,000 or 8,000 people at a World Cup, and you will see maybe 10 women out of 7,000 writers. So, yeah, it's still a very, very, very male-dominated field.
As a genre, sports books have as much or more passion as romance. Why do you think that is?
I think people are incredibly passionate about sports. There are a lot of my female friends don't like sports, and they wonder, why do I like sports? And I try to explain to them that sports, it's like theater. It's like drama. It's like a great movie. There's winners. There's losers. There are characters who are, you know, antagonistic. There are enemies and heroes and people overcoming great odds. So that's why I love sports writing, and I love reading sports books too, because athletes they're people who are really, really driven, passionate about what they do, and sometimes they have to overcome incredible odds to get there. Sometimes they face, you know, rivals that they can't stand, and so it makes for great theater when they're on the field or the court.
What books really made an impact on you that you think all aspiring sports writers should pick up?
Well, I made a little list. There are so many good sports books out there. There really are. And it kind of depends what sport you like and what sort of thing you like. I like the kind of books that are sort of behind the scenes of certain sports that really show you the inner workings of how a sport is. One of them that I loved was Friday Night Lights, which became a TV series, and it was a movie. And that's a book by H.G. Bissinger, and that's a book about a high school football team in Odessa, Texas. And through that football team, you learn about life in this little town in Texas and how even though there are racial divides, there are economic divides in that town, every Friday night, the whole community comes together because high school football is so huge in the state of Texas. And it was such a great story that it became this TV series. Another book that was a similar kind of thing is Blindside by Michael Lewis. And he takes one guy and really tells the story of football, tells the story of what does it take for a kid to get a college scholarship and then to be signed as a pro and everything that really happens behind the scene, but it's told. It reads like a novel. I mean, it really does read like a novel. And one that I just read in the last, I guess it was been 2 years now, but one of the best sports books I think I've ever read was Andre Agassi's autobiography, which was called Open. And it truly is, I mean, it's not just an autobiography where an athlete sits there and talks about, and then in this Wimbledon, I was going up against Pete Sampras and did that. No. Andre Agassi is an extremely candid, honest person. And through this book, Open, he gives such an incredibly honest and almost haunting look at the sport of tennis, and particularly youth tennis, junior tennis, where he explains how he hated tennis. He actually hated tennis, and a lot of the kids that were playing hated it, but they're doing it because their parents pushed them into it. And he explains it in great detail, going to these academies, being forced to play a sport he didn't necessarily love, but he was great at. And then he talks a lot about the personalities in tennis and the things that go on behind the scenes, and then his own struggles with drugs. He talks about taking crystal meth, and he talks about his marriage with Brooke Shields, and then what happened there, and then meeting Steffi Graf. But it's really, it's written so beautifully. Sally Jenkins did a biography on Lance Armstrong, which is called It's Not About the Bike, and it chronicles his battles with cancer and also all of the biking things with the Tour de France. But again, Sally Jenkins is one of my favorite sports writers of all time, and her dad is Dan Jenkins. I love Fever Pitch. by Nick Hornby. Fever Pitch is the best soccer book ever written. It's a fabulous book by an English writer about his love for Arsenal, for the team, the club Arsenal. Jane Levy did a book on Sandy Koufax. It was fabulous. And finally, I'll say one that is kind of a book that maybe a lot of people have never heard of, but I really love it. And as a sports writer, I would highly, highly recommend it. It's a book that came out in 1984, but you can still get it. I looked it up on Amazon. There's a new version. It's called The Thinking Man's Guide to Professional Football. Now, I'm a woman, so it's, you know, they really should change it to A Thinking Person's Guide, but it's a book called The Thinking Man's Guide to Professional Football, and it's written by Paul Zimmerman. He's better known as Dr. Z to people who read Sports Illustrated. He was a longtime NFL writer at Sports Illustrated, and he really knows the NFL and can write about the NFL almost like nobody that I've ever read before. And what he does in this book, The Thinking Man's Guide to Professional Football, is he breaks down each position, the running back, the quarterback, the cornerback, the wide receiver. And he explains in intricate, amazing detail what kind of person becomes, what kind of person is a wide receiver, how a wide receiver is a different person than a quarterback, how a quarterback is different from an offensive lineman. And then in great detail, by talking to so many people and interviewing so many people, describes the nuances of that position, of playing that position.
Are you heading off to London for the Olympics this summer?
Yes, I'll be in London for the Olympics. This will be my 12th Olympics, winter and summer. So it's really my favorite. The Olympics and the World Cup are my favorite events to cover for two different reasons. The World Cup, to me, is the most fascinating event because of the passion of the fans. There is no sporting event. And Americans don't understand that because Americans think the Super Bowl is a big deal. But it's really not. Yes, we have Super Bowl parties and there's Super Bowl commercials on TV. But the World Cup, every single country that's in the World Cup, except ours, the entire country is hanging on those 11 players, and the whole country shuts down. And so there's just an incredible passion in those stadiums when you go watch World Cup soccer live. There's nothing like it, no, absolutely nothing like it. You have to see it and experience it to really understand it. And then the Olympics, I love because those athletes train so hard for one little fleeting moment. And, you know, a 100-meter dash is 9.5 seconds. And there are people training for 8 years for a 9.5-second race. And if you have a bad day that day, if you wake up with a stomach ache on that morning, if you just step out of the blocks wrong on that day, you've been training 8 years for that moment. And it's just the biggest heartbreak. I just find that the Olympic stories, the triumphs are the most amazing triumphs, and the defeats are the most crushing, heart-crushing, heart-wrenching. Just to watch somebody who has trained so hard for so long fail and know that the next Olympics are 4 years away. It's not like you lose an NBA game, there's another game tomorrow. You lose a baseball game, there's another game tomorrow. It doesn't really matter, or there's next season. But in the Olympics, that's usually the athlete's only chance. 4 years from now, the athlete might be too old by then. So to me, there's just no drama like the Olympics, just because of it's every 4 years and the amount of training that goes into it, and the fact that athletes from every country across the globe are right now, this moment, swimming and doing gymnastics and running and doing fencing and whatever it is that they do, just for that one chance to stand on top of the podium and hear their national anthem. And for most of them, it'll never happen. Most of them will never get that moment. And yet that one little moment of watching their flag rise on the you know, when they win the gold medal, that's what drives them. And it's not money. It's not, other than track and field, it's not really driven by money. It's driven by this incredible desire to be the best at your sport. And I love the Olympics. So I'm really excited about going to London.
Well, we'll be excited to read your stories from there. Thank you so much for stopping by today. Thanks, Michelle.
Sure, anytime.
readers, I'm a proud Gator mom.
My daughter Haley is a University of Florida grad who was lucky enough to be in Gainesville when it was known as Title Town. Go Gators! So, as you can imagine, Tim Tebow has been frequent dinner table conversation at our house. Now, of course, Tim is moving up in his career. In Through My Eyes, Tebow, with Nathan Whitaker, writes an inspirational memoir about life as he chooses to live it, revealing how his faith and family values, combined with his relentless will to succeed, have molded him into the person he is today. As the son of Christian missionaries, Tebow has a unique story to tell, from the circumstances of his birth to his homeschooled roots, to his record-setting collegiate football career and beyond. Through My Eyes is his passionate firsthand account of how it all really happened. Tom Whalen narrates.
Since I first started playing high school football, a lot has been written about me. Some true, some not so true. Some positive, some not so positive, and some of it claiming to even know my mindset and motivation. It's not always the easiest thing to be the center of so much spilled ink. You read glowing things, and it doesn't feel deserved. You read things that are critical, and it cuts you to the bone. It's because of both those extremes of others' opinions that I felt it the natural thing to do to tell my story, written from my perspective. It also seemed like the right thing to do, perhaps in many instances, to simply set the record straight, sharing my story as I see it, as I remember it, including my actual mindset and motivation. Sharing it all, what is true and actually happened. Some of it positive, and some perhaps still not so positive. That's the nature of truth. But all of it is my story. Through my eyes. In addition, the sheer amount that has been written about me also seems to indicate that, for whatever reason, a great number of people have a significant interest in me. In some respects, that is very flattering. I'd guess that any one of us would be flattered by that level of interest. However, my parents always told me, from an early age, that we all have the ability to influence others, whether through our words or actions, or both. They always added that, besides possessing the ability, we also have the responsibility to use it in a positive, encouraging, and uplifting way. A platform. Who knows? Maybe my platform will be the same in 5 years. Maybe not. One thing I'm confident of is that the Lord already knows the answer to that, and He has a plan for it all. That is something I've learned to have the utmost assurance of and faith in. His daily, weekly, monthly, total, and eternal plan for our lives. Therefore, I have learned that though God is in control of the big picture, I am responsible for how I use my platform, whatever its size, at this moment in time, to influence others. Or whatever my age, or wherever I am, or no matter what is going on in my life at any time, I have a platform that He can use for His good purposes, and perhaps even the good of others, today. We all know of people who thought they could do it, whatever it is, tomorrow. We have all procrastinated in such a way, and often to our personal regret. It happens time and again, putting off things that we convince ourselves might be better, more meaningful, more appropriate for another time. So often, that better time either never comes, or really isn't better, or more appropriate after all. And then, sadly, the window of opportunity to do something great closes. Here's something else that I haven't always grasped, but which in the last few years I have come to understand in my own life, and which now burns in my heart for others to also recognize and realize. We all have stories to share. We all have life experiences that can bless the lives of others, whoever we are. Wherever we find ourselves, whatever we are involved in, no matter our age or station in life. Stories that, when shared with others, can make a positive difference in this world. As I tell my story, I hope that you will see that its true focus is on God and on those eternal values that He holds before us as beacons and benchmarks to help us live lives of abundance that will ultimately glorify Him while also lifting and bettering the lives of His children everywhere.
That was Through My Eyes by Tim Tebow. ESPN began as an outrageous gamble with a lineup that included Australian rules football, rodeo, and a rinky-dink clip show called SportsCenter. Today, the empire stretches far beyond TV into radio, magazines, mobile phones, restaurants, video games, and more. ESPN's personalities have become global superstars. In Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN by James Andrew Miller and Tom Shales, celebrities Chris Berman, Keith Olbermann, Hannah Storm, Tony Kornheiser, Aaron Andrews, Mike Ditka, and scores of others speak openly about the games, the shows, the scandals, gambling addictions, bitter rivalries, and sudden suspensions that make up the network's soaring and stormy history. The result is a wild, raucous story of triumph, genius, ego, and the rise of an empire. James Andrew Miller, Matt McCarthy, and Joan Baker narrate.
Of the 43 stalwarts being honored with their own stars on the ESPN Walk of Fame on this super summer afternoon, Berman, practically the network's avatar, and Bob, the General Lee, spelled L-E-Y, the network's best journalist, are not only the most recognizable ESPN personalities, but among the most recognizable guys ever to have a mic pack jab their rear ends. The two soak up the admiring applause of several hundred in the audience, other honorees, ESPN employees, and family members, press, and guests. In a moment that is somehow pure ESPN, Bob Lee looks down at his star and does a double take when he sees Rob Lee, L-E-E, spelled out in gold lettering, a double whammy of a blooper that causes colleague Bill Shanahan, standing next to Lee, to explode in guffaws. Some might consider this a perfect reminder that through the years, ESPN management has never liked its personalities to become big names anyway. Big names demand big bucks. They prefer keeping the talent humble. Bodenheimer handles the officiating with presidential aplomb alongside Sage Steele, born 7 years before ESPN was, as his mistress of ceremonies. Bodenheimer had rejected the organizing committee's first suggestion of an MC and made the outstanding choice of Steele himself, who represents everything you could ask for in an anchor. Berman and Lee speechify, then join other honorees posing for photos next to their stars, the Walk of Fame kind, misspellings and all, and also with Bodenheimer, who on this day seems more benevolently paternalistic than ever. Then they all adjourn to the ESPN Cafe and eat cake to commemorate the spectacular growth of the past 3 decades. ESPN was a funky little seat-of-the-pants operation in 1979 when it started, in a town so dull that employees worked 18-hour days to keep from dying of boredom outside. ESPN now encompasses 6 domestic U.S. cable networks, 46 international networks, ESPN Radio in North America and syndicated radio in 11 other far-flung countries, plus online operations, broadband, magazines, books, interactive media, wireless, CDs and DVDs, video games and restaurants, all helping to pump coverage of more than 65 different sports into television sets, computers, and mobile phones in more than 250 countries. Once a bastard stepchild filed, along with Almond Groves, under Other among the holdings of Getty Oil, ESPN is now the most important component of the Disney empire, worth more than the entire National Football League, worth more than the NBA, MLB, and the NHL put together. This audiobook pursues the mystery of ESPN's rise to stratospheric heights from subterranean depths. It reveals how a crazy idea grew into one of the most successful media enterprises of all time. Those guys have all the fun. The men and women you will meet here spend their days and nights talking and thinking about sports. Hard as they work, ESPNers toil in an environment that most folks would consider pure pleasure. And when they aren't working, ESPNers still have all the fun, or at least most of it. At ESPN, partying is a varsity sport. What follows is not the history, but the story of ESPN. It would take a dozen or more weighty volumes to provide an all-encompassing account of ESPN's innumerable hours of nonstop broadcasting through more than 30 sports-saturated years. Still more time and space would be needed to fully chronicle the many thousands who have come and gone, or come and stayed, over the decades. Still, many of those who have entered ESPN's orbit are here, and here in their own words. To create this audiobook, over 550 people were interviewed, and the words you hear are their own. In some instances, their quotes have been cleaned up, removing, for example, the ums and the uhs that accompany most conversation, and certain discussions for the sake of clarity and exposition have been moved or compacted. But otherwise, what you hear is precisely as it was told to us. One thing that can be stated from the start is that the odds of ESPN happening just the way it did are somewhere in the neighborhood of a zillion to one. All sports, all the time, 24/7 and 365 days a year? When the notion was hatched back in 1978, it was liberally ridiculed, even though logic and precedent tell us that eventually, somehow and somewhere, someone would have looked at the tremendous growth of sports and sporting events in the United States, noticed the morphing of athletes into superstar celebrities, taken stock of the wide open explosion in the number of potential cable networks, and realized that tens, even hundreds of millions of dollars were lying around waiting to be made.
That was Those Guys Have All the Fun by James Andrew Miller and Tom Shales. From the moment Larry Bird and Magic Johnson took the court on opposing sides, they engaged in a fierce physical and psychological battle. Their uncommonly competitive relationship came to symbolize one of the most compelling rivalries in the NBA. The basketball epics of the 1980s were Celtics versus Lakers, East versus West, physical versus finesse, old school versus showtime. Each pushed the other to greatness. Together, Bird and Johnson collected 8 NBA championships and 6 MVP awards and helped save the NBA at its most critical time. When it started, they were bitter rivals, but along the way, they became lifelong friends. When the Game Was Ours, written with Jackie McMullen, transports fans to an electric era of basketball. We come to understand Larry's obsessive devotion to winning and how his demons drove him on the court. We hear him talk with candor about playing through chronic pain. In Magic, we see a young, invincible star struggle with the sting of defeat, not just as a player, but as a team leader. And we are there the moment he learns he's contracted HIV and hear in his own words how that devastating news impacted his relationships in basketball and beyond. With Dick Hill's narration, it's a rollicking ride through some of pro basketball's best times.
The coach didn't play us, so we had to figure out other ways besides playing in the games to prove we belonged among the best college players. Trust me, you'll see when you read this. We figured out ways to get noticed. In this book, we'll give you the inside story of our days leading up to the NCAA National Championship. Not what I call the fish stories that are out there. Through the years, countless people who were on the fringe of our Indiana State team have been quoted about what I was doing or what I was thinking back then. I'm always amused by that, because I barely know them, which is why they never get the story right. People who have the least to do with the success of a team often have the most to say about it. That's one of the reasons Magic and I decided to do this book together. For once, you can hear from us what we were feeling when we played against each other for the NCAA championship and those NBA championships. It's been an interesting ride, believe me. It hasn't always been a smooth one, either. When you are as competitive as the two of us are, there's going to be bad feelings along the way. I had them. And after doing this project, I've learned Magic had some, too. After years of battling each other, people couldn't think of one of us without the other. We were Frazier and Ali. When I retired, people asked me about him all the time. They'd say, "Is Magic okay? Have you seen him?" Even more than my own teammates. 9 times out of 10, it was, "So what's Magic doing?" And 1 time out of 10, it was, "What's McHale up to these days?" It's hard to explain what it's like to be linked to someone like that. We didn't choose for it to be that way. It just happened. And now we're stuck with each other. Once, a few years ago, I was driving down the road in my car, and I got a call from a television reporter in Indianapolis. He asked me, "Have you heard the news?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, it isn't confirmed yet, but we've got a report that Magic Johnson died." I almost went off the road. I got this pit in my stomach, and I really felt like I was going to lose it. I hung up and called Jill Leone, my agent, right away. She got on the phone with Lon Rosen, Magic's agent, and he told her it was a bad rumor that Magic was fine. I called that TV guy back and said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." People have been writing about Magic and me for years. Some of it they got right. Some of it they didn't. This is our story from the two people who lived it. When the Celtics and the Lakers played in the 2008 finals, it brought back a lot of great memories for me. Those were the greatest times of my life, those battles with Magic and the Lakers. They were all I thought about. Nothing was sweeter than beating L.A. We fought like hell for the same thing for over 12 years, and through it all, the respect was always there. For the rest of our lives, we're connected. I used to mind. I don't anymore. Larry Bird, Indianapolis, March 2009. From Magic. My high school coach, George Fox, used to tell me to never take my talent for granted. "You're special, Irvin," Fox used to say, "but you can't stop working hard. Just remember, there's someone out there who is just as talented as you are, and he's working just as hard, maybe even harder." When Coach Fox told me those things, I'd nod my head, but in my mind I was thinking, "I'd like to meet this guy because I haven't seen him." Truthfully, I wasn't sure anybody like that existed. That changed the day in 1978 when I walked into a gym in Lexington, Kentucky, and met Larry Bird for the first time. Then I knew he was the guy Coach Fox was talking about. Larry was a different kind of cat. He didn't say much, and he kept to himself. But oh, could he play. I had never seen a player with his size pass the ball the way he did. Right away, we had chemistry. We played on the second team with a bunch of college all-stars, and we just embarrassed the starters. I knew I'd see him again, and I did. Everywhere.
That was When the Game Was Ours by Larry Bird and Irvin Johnson. At 5 feet, 10 inches tall, running back Walter Payton was not the largest player in the NFL, but he developed a larger-than-life reputation for his strength, speed, and grit. Nicknamed Sweetness during his college football days, he became the NFL's all-time leader in rushing and all-purpose yards, capturing the hearts of fans in his adopted Chicago. Drawing from hundreds of interviews, acclaimed sports writer Jeff Perlman crafts the first definitive biography of Payton, Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton. The book brings fans a detailed, scrupulously researched, all-encompassing account of the legend's rise to greatness. From Payton's childhood in segregated Mississippi to his college years and his 13-year NFL career, Sweetness brims with stories of all-American heroism and covers Payton's life on and off the field. Set against the backdrop of the tragic illness that cut his life short at age 45, Malcolm Hilgartner performs a stirring tribute to the sports icon.
Although he had been retired for 12 years at the time we met, football players old and young still mythologized Payton's Hill, an incline that once stood near his house in Arlington Heights, Illinois. It was just 60 yards long, but rose at an angle of 75 degrees, with loose dirt and small rocks and pebbles, making footing treacherous. All off-season long, Payton would be sprinting the hill, up and down, up and down, up and down. "He'd invite some of the guys to work with him," said Vince Evans, a former Bears quarterback. "If you hadn't been to the hill before, he'd look at you and laugh, because Walter would just climb up that like a bobcat, and you'd follow in his dust. I was a pretty good athlete, so the first time I said, "This ain't nothing." Well, halfway up, I was sucking air. Once that one was over, he said we were going to do 10 more. 10? That was the real eye-opener to this guy's power. So how the hell did this make sense? Me fidgeting before a man who looked nothing like the 5'10", 205-pound ball of iron from McMurrin's memories. According to the public statements of his doctors, Peyton needed a liver transplant to survive beyond 2 years. That was, it turns out, incorrect. By the time we met, Peyton's body was already ravaged by bile duct cancer, an awful byproduct of primary sclerosing cholangitis. His odds of survival? Infinitesimal. I can only imagine what Peyton must have been thinking, staring at a trembling Sports Illustrated reporter a mere 4 years removed from college. "I'm dying, and this is who you send?" He had that right. I was completely unqualified. I knew nothing about liver disease, little about suffering, and even less about death. In the entirety of my life, I had lost only 2 close relatives, both grandparents in their 80s. "I'm dying, and this is who you send?" The interview was mostly me looking down at a sheet of paper with a list of medical terms, reading a few words, then glancing Peyton's way and saying, So, are you in a lot of pain?" He was polite enough, under the circumstances, but surely as anxious to end things as I was. When my father inquired later that evening what it was like meeting a football player whose poster once graced my bedroom wall, I didn't hesitate. "Worst experience of my life," I sighed. "Like watching a superhero die." More than a decade has passed since my visit to Hoffman Estates. In that span, I've gained a wife and 2 children. I've written 4 books, penned a slew of bylines, traveled a good chunk of the world. I have seen and lived and smelled and tasted and heard. It has been a mostly blissful ride, packed with enough highs to minimize the scattered lows. Through the years, interviews have come and interviews have gone. I'll occasionally dig through the yellowed scrapbooks, stumbling upon stories I'd completely forgotten about. Ronnie Duquette, the sneaker collector from Oregon. A Maopac high school football player named Mark Desi. Theo Ratliff, gangly 76ers center. On and on. Never, however, have I forgotten my 30 minutes with Walter Peyton. I can still see the brightness of his jaundiced eyes. I can still feel the frailty of his handshake. Most important, I can still hear his voice from that day, a strained yet high-pitched blur of words and phrases. Throughout this process, I have used that voice as a guide.
That was Sweetness by Jeff Perlman. On December 28, 1958, the New York Giants and Baltimore Colts met under the lights of Yankee Stadium for that season's NFL championship game. Football, growing in popularity, was still greatly overshadowed by baseball, but the 1958 championship would prove to be the turning point. On the field and roaming the sidelines were 17 future Hall of Famers, including Colts stars Johnny Unitas, Raymond Barry, and Gino Marchetti, and Giants greats Frank Gifford, Sam Huff, and assistant coaches Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry. Playing on a freezing Sunday evening in front of 64,000 fans and an estimated 45 million TV viewers, at that time the largest crowd to have ever watched a football game, the championship would become the first sudden-death contest in NFL history. With 2 minutes left in regulation, Baltimore had possession deep in its own territory and the ball in the hands of the still unproven quarterback Johnny Unitas. The best game ever, Colts vs. Giants 1958 and the birth of the modern NFL by Mark Bowden, is a compelling portrait of how a single game impacted the history of American sports. Phil Giganti narrates.
At the home of the famous doggerel poet and Colts fan Ogden Nash in suburban Baltimore, the entire Nash family was gathered in the living room. At a novitiate in Baltimore, burdened with a mean-spirited local ecclesiastical admonition against watching the game on TV, The obedient but clever Mother Superior draped a blanket over the set. There was no rule against listening. Many of the viewers just beginning to tune in were not regular watchers of pro football, and they were seeing something starkly different than the traditional college games played on sunny autumn afternoons. This was more like a mortal combat from some dark underworld. As in some medieval rite, the players on both sidelines were draped in long capes. A master cinematographer could not have lit the scene more dramatically. In the shadow of the stands, men wore long wool overcoats and gloves. Many wrapped wool scarves over their heads, covering their ears, and scrunched fedoras on top of the scarves. They smoked cigarettes or cigars, and when they cheered or spoke, their faces would momentarily cloud in smoke and steam. Beneath the red, white, and blue bunting draped from the second tier, the stand smelled of tobacco and beer and occasionally a whiff of whiskey or rum or the pungent stab of a struck match. 19-year-old William Gildea, who would grow up to be a sports writer for the Washington Post, was there with his father, sitting high over one of the end zones. They had been going to Colts games together since the first one the team had played in 1947, and had taken the train from Baltimore to New York the day before. Behind the end zone on the eastern side of the stadium, out where the left field bullpen was during baseball season, stood Neil Leifer with his Yashica Matte twin lens reflex camera. It was Neil's 16th birthday, and he was spending it the way he had spent every Sunday afternoon that season. He had joined a camera club at the Henry Street Settlement House, to where the camera and film he carried had been donated. The club had taught him to shoot, develop, and print his own pictures, and he had discovered a potential market for them with the magazines and wire services around town. Neil knew their deadlines, and he had shopped his work after every home game. So far, he hadn't had any luck, but this was a big game. He had to be on the field for the shots he wanted, but the club wasn't handing out sideline passes to teenagers with borrowed cameras. Neil was tenacious, though. He had learned that before every game, busloads of disabled veterans arrived at the loading ramps outside Yankee Stadium's outfield walls. There was no place for men in wheelchairs up in the stands, but the Giants allowed them to watch from their chairs against the outfield wall behind the end zone. They even provided blankets and hot coffee. When the buses started arriving from the various veterans' hospitals in the hour before kickoff, there was always a need for able-bodied volunteers to push them into the stadium. Neil knew that the stadium guards and cops, in return for his help, would let him stick around. Sometimes they would even let him creep up the sidelines, although usually the accredited photographers would kick up a fuss and he would have to come back. The market for still shots from the game was small, and the pro shooters didn't welcome competition, even from a 16-year-old on his birthday. The surly culture of beery male boorishness that would come to typify football crowds had not yet taken hold, so there were many women in the stands. They, too, wrapped scarves around their heads and across their faces and huddled under blankets. Joanne Kemp, the young wife of Giants backup quarterback Jack Kemp, was there, pregnant with their first child, Jeff, who would grow up to be an NFL quarterback. Marcia Hirsch was huddled under a blanket with her mother. She was 16 and had come up from Baltimore on the bus with a big group of Colts rooters who were now in the upper deck over the 50-yard line. Her father, Abe, who owned a furniture store, was so excited that he screamed himself hoarse. Years later, Marcia would remember his eyes glowing with excitement as he had rasped to her, "History is being made."
That was The Best Game Ever by Mark Bowden. After numerous beloved and best-selling sports books, John Feinstein crafts a narrative of the most revealing encounters he's had. In One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats of the Game, Feinstein has interviewed some of the most enduring figures in sports, from hallowed coaches such as Bob Knight, Jim Valvano, and Dean Smith, to beloved athletes including Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Arnold Palmer, and John McEnroe. Here, Feinstein goes behind the scenes of his reporting from the Final Four, Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, the Olympics, and more, opening up sports' most private closed-doors places and sharing exclusive stories. David DeVries narrates.
This is not exactly the book I thought I would write in 2011. I always thought there might come a point in my life when I would go back and talk to all the people I encountered while researching A Season on the Brink 25 years ago. I knew exactly where the book would begin and where it would end. I would fill in the blanks in between by talking to the players and coaches I got to know so well in the winter of 1985-86 in Bloomington, Indiana. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that a Boys of Summer book wasn't really what I wanted to do. What made that book unique, besides Roger Kahn's writing, was the bittersweet nature of the storyline. Young, powerful men, 20 years later, stripped of that which made them powerful and dealing with the harsh realities of getting older. There's really very little that's bittersweet about the characters in Season on the Brink. Sure, Bob Knight got fired after 29 years at Indiana, but who among us was surprised to see him self-destruct and then blame everyone else for his own failings? Most of the other people in the book had gone on to lead successful lives, a handful in basketball, some in law or medicine, while others had gone home to family businesses. If there was one thing Knight always did well as a coach, it was prepare his players for life after basketball. The kids in A Season on the Brink, all in their 40s now, were a bright group who would find their way in life, probably in ways that were difficult for the old Dodgers of Kahn's book to accomplish. All are college graduates. Most knew they probably weren't going to play in the NBA. Only one actually did play in the NBA, Steve Alford, who played for 4 years before becoming a college coach. After a lot of thought, I realized how lucky I had been to write the books I'd written. I had come in contact with so many different people from across the spectrum of sports. I hadn't just been in Bob Knight's locker room. I'd been in Mike Krzyzewski's and Jim Valvano's and Larry Brown's locker rooms. I was never in Dean Smith's or John Thompson's, but I'd certainly had plenty of interactions with the two of them, too. I had also been in both locker rooms during an Army-Navy game, a distinction usually reserved, I believe, for those who hold the office of President of the United States. I had spent hours and hours with Tom Watson and Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and John McEnroe and Yvonne Lendl and Pete Sampras and Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert, not to mention Joe Torre and Bobby Cox and Tony La Russa and Deion Sanders. I even spent an evening once with Tiger Woods. Yep, seriously. There were others, not nearly as famous, but perhaps more fascinating, and at least as admirable. Paul Goidos, Bruce Edwards, Chris Spittler, and Steve Kerr, who is at least semi-famous. And then there were the young men I got to know and liked so much while writing A Civil War and The Last Amateurs. I had dust-ups around the world with security people, Pravda, and the Czechoslovakian secret police. I learned from people like Bob Woodward, David Moranis, and Tony Kornheiser, and battled with editors, notably George Solomon, who helped launch my career. So why not go back and talk to all those people? Going into one's past can be dangerous. You might be disappointed by those you revisit. The way they react to you, what they have become, the stories they don't have to tell. But I was lucky. I found the people I wanted to find, and every one of them reacted to my reappearance in their lives exactly as I would have hoped. Or, in the case of Bob Knight, exactly as I'd expected.
We've just heard One-on-One by John Feinstein. The most popular sports columnist in America puts his life and dignity on the line in the search for the most absurd sporting events on the planet. Rick Riley writes Sports from Hell, my search for the world's dumbest competition. Exactly what is the stupidest sport in the world? Not content to pontificate from the sidelines, Rick Riley set out on a global journey with stops in Australia, New Zealand, Finland, Denmark, England, and even a maximum security prison in Louisiana to discover the answer to this enduring question. From the physically and mentally taxing sport of chess boxing to the psychological battlefield that is rock, paper, scissors, Riley, in his valiant quest, subjected himself to both bodily danger and abject humiliation. These fringe sports offer their participants a chance to earn a few bucks and achieve the eternal glory that is winning, even when the victory in question might strike some as pointless. It's debatable whether these sports push the body or just human idiocy to the outermost limits, but one thing is for sure, sports in hell is laugh-out-loud hilarious. Mike Chamberlain narrates.
Sports writing can be about as tough as fur boxers. I've spooned the strawberries and cream at Wimbledon, slurped the mint juleps at the Kentucky Derby, sneezed into the azaleas at the Masters. I've sat on leather pressroom couches in front of glorious big screens from Dubai to Del Mar, while pages of athletes' quotes were hand-delivered to me. I've been courtside at the Final Four and on the field for the Super Bowl, and nearly had Mary Lou Retton land her famous tens at the 1984 Olympics on my foot. I've covered all the sports everybody aches to attend. Do you know how boring that gets? After 31 years of covering crap like that, I wanted to try covering some sports that were completely new, totally obscure, and mind-warpingly dumb. The dumber, the better. I wanted to see if I could search the planet and find the single stupidest idea for sporting competition the world had ever devised. The thrill of victory, the forehead slap of, "Why do you people do this?" My motto was, if your sport is really moronic and witless, I'm the guy to write about it. So, accompanied by my curvy girlfriend, Cynthia Puknosh, a.k.a. TLC, the lovely Cynthia, a former Glendale, California high school teacher, former Miss Teen California, and current research wizard, I set out in January of 2006 to do it. But first, over many, many tequilas, we decided on some ground rules. 1. It had to be an actual sport, meaning it had to be something people actually tried to win, something people cared about, something open to anybody. There are dozens of try-to-fly-off-the-end-of-the-pier contests, bags full of who can come up with the dumbest craft to sail the dry river regattas. Pah! It had to be dumb to everybody but those who played it. In fact, our rule of thumb was, if you would get punched if you told a guy his sport was stupid, it qualified. 2. It couldn't be stupid for the sake of being stupid. For instance, the World Shin-Kicking Championships, which involves two combatants, their hands on each other's shoulders, kicking each other very hard in the shins, seemed to have real stupidity potential. But then we saw this quote from a shin-kicking official who was trying to get shin-kicking into the 2012 Olympics. There's no need for dope tests. If anything, stupidity is encouraged. That nixed it. You can't know your sport is stupid. 3. It couldn't exist mainly as tourist bait. It couldn't scream out, "Yes, this is a dumb sport, and that's why the boys in marketing invented it, so you would come and spend all your euros." The British are just awful about this. Take bog snorkeling, in which one dives into a disgusting muck-filled trench and swims 120 yards with the proviso that one can't pull one's head out of the water. Besides, when one does come out, one finds one still in mid-Wales, so one just keeps swimming. Or cheese rolling, which involves letting a giant double Gloucester cheese wheel roll down a hill, triggering 100 or so drunk 22-year-olds falling over Guinness in an attempt to be the first one across the line after it. In 2008, 18 of the 50 contestants were injured. You know what I say? Good! 4. We had to actually watch people do it. There have been some wonderfully spackle-brained sports that no longer exist. Take the World Housekeeping Championships, for instance.
That was Sports from Hell by Rick Riley. Readers, I know there's strong competition for your time, so I'm honored to offer up help when you're looking for your next read. Simply go to my website, bookreportradio.com. You'll score lots of ideas there. Thanks so much for joining us, and I hope your team is making its way through the brackets to the Final Four. I look forward to seeing you back here next week on The Book Report.